From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Brexit is here. Let the wrangling begin. Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney, and this is To the Point. After hundreds of years of almost continuous warfare, 28 nations created the European Union. Now the UK is becoming the first to go back on its own. The British exit, or Brexit, began today, and nobody thinks the next 2 years are going to be pretty. Scotland might even declare independence from the UK. Remaining EU countries don't want to punish Britain, but they don't want to make leaving look easy either. Can they agree on new rules for imports, exports, tariffs, and immigration as 6 decades of cooperation ends in historic divorce? Later on today's Talking Point, with a swipe of the pen, President Trump can make internet privacy a thing of the past. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Olney, back with To The Point. The head of the European Union says, "We're missing you already." But British Prime Minister Theresa May says there is no turning back. She's made this day one of Brexit as the UK becomes the first nation to break away after 60 years of European unity. That's our topic today. On our Talking Point later, both houses of Congress have voted to give Comcast, Time Warner, and other internet providers permission to spy on every American and sell intimate information to the highest bidder. If President Trump signs the bill, are there any protections left? First, this news update. Last week's failure to repeal and replace Obamacare was a big blow to Republicans, even though President Trump blamed the Democrats. Now 44 Democratic senators have signed a letter saying they'll work with him if full repeal is off the table. Here's Press Secretary Sean Spicer today.
He's continued to have conversations with the Senate, and I think that as Obamacare continues to struggle, which it is, the premiums continue to go up and up. I think the question is, you know, will those 40 people understand that they are the ones who are going to be responsible for owning the current policies that are making so many Americans struggle?
He said 40 people, actually 44 Democratic senators, indicated they're willing to work with the White House. Jonathan Cohn is senior national correspondent for the Huffington Post. Good to have you as always.
Good to be on the show.
Is there a chance of bipartisanship on this?
I think that depends entirely on how big and when. I don't imagine there's much appetite on either side for a big health care bill right now. I mean, fundamentally, the Republicans, most of the Republican Party remains committed to repealing the law, and that's a non-starter with the Democrats. So if that's where the conversation is, then no, there is no bipartisanship. On the other hand, I think it is true that Democrats have always said, hey, we never thought this was, you know, a perfect law. We know it's been in working, you know, it's been in operation for a few years now. We now see what's going right, what's not going wrong. We're happy to work on fixing it. So I think it's possible to imagine a world with some small-scale bipartisanship, with some tweaks to the law, which really is, frankly, all the law needs to kind of, when we think about what's working and what's not, it doesn't actually take much to fix the problems that we've seen. Whether that could happen right away, is that something that happens in a couple of months? Is that something that maybe has to wait till the midterms? Which, and if you can imagine a Democratic House, I mean, to me, I can imagine a Democratic House and a Republican Senate and Trump coming together. It's pretty hard, you know, the same people, the Freedom Caucus and the House, those really hardcore conservatives, they're going to make trouble on just about anything moving on health care. So that's a real issue in terms of if bipartisanship, if we're talking about actual legislation and passing laws, which is, you know, what people usually mean in that context.
So Sean Spicer says Obamacare is struggling. You say that it needs some tweaks. Is it possible that the president could sort of rescue his presidency from all the confusion that we've heard if he can drive a bargain that gets the Senate at least to go along? Would that put so much pressure on the House that they'd have to go along too?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. We're in a bit of a kind of, you know, we're in a little bit of unknown territory here. There are, you know, Spicer says, you know, the program's falling apart. Tom Price says that. The Republicans say that it's not falling apart. Like any other new program, it's got, you know, it's doing well in some places. It's not doing well in some other places. Again, you know, a few years into it, people are, you know, we can now see how it operates, and you could say, okay, here's what worked, here's what didn't, here's what you need to do to fix the parts that don't work. You know, Trump, to me, is not a very ideological person. I don't think, at least on this issue, I don't think he's particularly wedded to the Paul Ryan vision of health care. So you could imagine him, you know, cutting a deal with the Senate in that way. But again, you know, I think that's going to take time. So the more immediate question is, what does he do through his administration? Because he's got to run this program for the next year or two. And you know, what actions does he take, and how does that affect the trajectory of the program?
You mentioned Tom Price. He's, of course, a doctor. He's now head of Health and Human Services Department. He was a congressman from Georgia, very much on the side of Paul Ryan with regard to getting rid of Obamacare. Is it possible that he could undermine Obamacare through policies of his department?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a pretty wide range that the administration has in front of it. If it wants to undermine the program, it can. I mean, it's got a few tools. The most immediate is there's this court case hanging out there that was filed by the House Republicans a few years ago, and they actually won the initial case in the federal district court, which basically it would block extra money that the insurance companies get to lower out-of-pocket costs for people. And if that case prevails, then it's going to wreak havoc in all the markets, even in places like California, where the law has been working pretty well. And, you know, it's up to the administration. The Obama administration appealed that decision, and they had a sort of good chance of winning in the end for complicated legal reasons. But the Trump administration could decide not to appeal that decision, just say, hey, Obama was going to appeal, but we're just going to let the decision stand. That would cause real problems. They could not, you know, other things they could do, they could not promote enrollment so that, like, you start to see fewer and fewer people signing up, and that makes it harder for the insurance companies to stay in business. So they could, if they want to, undermine it. The flip side is they own this right now. I mean, they run it. And you, even if you listen to Price today, I think, a little bit, there's a sense, I think they know they own it, so they're kind of walking this tightrope of, well, we hate this law. We think it's terrible. It's falling apart. We want to get rid of it. But actually, we kind of have to run it.
Jonathan Cohen with the Washington Post. Many thanks, as always. Great to have you with us.
Thanks.
In a moment, Brexit is here. Let the wrangling begin on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're holding back with To the Point. 60 years ago, 28 nations made history by ending hundreds of years of almost unending warfare and forming the European Union. Today, Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May made history of a different kind by formally notifying the EU that her country is pulling out.
The Article 50 process is now underway, and in accordance with the wishes of the British people, the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
Theresa May addressing the Parliament. You can hear them in the background. Jeremy Cliff is a political editor and columnist for The Economist magazine. Good to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
She started talking about Article 50. What's that?
Article 50 is the process by which a country leaves the European Union. Until recently, there wasn't actually an official process. The idea was that if you left it completely vague, then countries wouldn't leave. Anyway, for better or worse, Britain has decided to leave the European Union, and as of 2009, there's now this protocol by which a country does that. And it takes 2 years, and the day that the country country announces its intention to leave the union, the clock starts ticking, and that's what's happened today.
We have known, of course, for months that this was going to happen. So what's so important about today? What was this announcement all about?
Well, in many ways, it was quite a symbolic announcement. You know, we knew it was coming. Theresa May had said a few months ago that she intended to launch Article 50 by the end of this month. You know, there was the pantomime of the British representative taking the letter to the European Council in Brussels and formally informing them that Britain was leaving the club. There was the drama and the theatre of Theresa May going to the Houses of Parliament and announcing that this has happened. But also there's a technocratic aspect of it, which is that as of today, the negotiations properly begin. And until now, the Europeans have been pretty pretty reluctant to talk about Brexit. You know, the view is that the phrase they use in Brussels is no negotiation before notification. Well, notification has happened today, and so the negotiations will begin.
I happened to be in London when the Brexit vote was announced, and everybody I talked to in London was outraged by it. What's the mood now in the country?
Yeah, I think I remember we talked at that point.
We did, and indeed.
Britain has moved on a fair bit since then. You know, there was a lot of shock. That vote gave way to a period of a few months in which there was tremendous turmoil in British politics. David Cameron, the Prime Minister, resigned. There was a leadership contest in the Conservative Party that led to Theresa May becoming Prime Minister. There was a leadership contest in the opposition Labour Party, which led to the incumbent leader being re-elected. There was a real sense of sort of chaos and uncertainty. That's settled down now. But I think there are still a lot of underlying concerns. You know, businesses are still looking at their positions, wondering whether or not the deal that Britain will get with the European Union enables them to remain in the in the UK, or whether they should consider investing in the EU. And that's particularly true of companies like car makers and finance firms, banks, you know, some of Britain's strongest industries, who are particularly reliant on trade with the European continent. So, yes, we're in a more stable position than we were last summer, but there are still a lot of question marks over Britain's future.
Well, and Article 50, as you indicated, is still vague. It's going to take 2 years to figure out what the terms are. So I would think the main concern at the moment is uncertainty.
Totally. And, you know, a lot of Britain's future now is in the hands of countries outside, you know, people outside Britain, basically. The negotiations that are now starting to take place give the remaining 27 members of the European Union a lot of power over Britain's future. You know, there's a lot of bombast in London, a lot of patriotism. You know, the newspapers are all putting the Union Jack on the front page and talking about Britain fighting back. But the reality is that whether Britain retains its rights to trade freely with the rest of the European Union, whether tariffs will be imposed, whether or not its regulatory regime will have to change, whether or not British people living on continental Europe will retain the right to do so, all of that is now in the hands of the Europeans. And so, you know, this was in some ways the point at which Theresa May lost control of the process. You know, it was up to her in the months running up to today to shape what Britain's asks were of this negotiation. But now it's really up to the Europeans, and in particular the most powerful leaders in Europe, most notably Germany and Angela Merkel, to decide whether or not they're happy to let Britain do that. And I think the view in a lot of European capitals is Britain should get a fair deal. You know, there is not a sort of vindictive mood in the rest of Europe, but there is also a sense that Britain can't just walk out of the European Union and then cherry-pick the bits of membership that it always liked. You know, there has to be some sense that membership of the EU is the best deal on the table. So we're going to have to see how that all plays out.
Jeremy Cliff, again, political editor and columnist at The Economist. Ryan Bourne is an economist, too. He's at the Cato Institute. That's a libertarian think tank, and he's founding member of Economists for Brexit. Welcome to you.
Good to be with you. Hi.
Why is this good for Britain?
Well, I think it gives us a huge opportunity in the longer term. And Jeremy talked about losing control of the process in negotiating our exit. But in the long term, of course, the payoff is that we're going to get a repatriation of a huge range of powers on trade, on regulation, on public spending as well, because we make a significant net contribution to the European Union. So really, Britain's future is going to be shaped by how we use those powers. And I think Jeremy and I would both agree that successful economies tend to be ones that are as open and dynamic and as liberal as possible. I actually think Brexit is an opportunity to make the UK even more liberal and even more dynamic than we currently are inside the European Union.
Jeremy just said, though, that the countries outside of Europe, the other 27 members of the EU, now have power that they didn't have before. What's to prevent them from using it, even if they don't feel vindictive now? Why might they not in the future?
Because it's not in their interest to do so. The main economic negotiation that's going to take place is whether we have a comprehensive free trade deal with the rest of the European Union. Now, the whole point about free trade is it's mutually beneficial. Trade primarily benefits consumers in both countries. And if the European Union were to decide not to agree a free trade deal over the coming years and start imposing tariffs and start imposing restrictions on the export of service industries, not least financial services, into the European Union, then the primary people who would suffer from that are European Union consumers. Now, I totally accept that there are some politicians in Europe that take this line, that take this sort of bombastic line, which sort of suggests that their main aim is not to enhance the economic interests of their citizens, but to protect the integrity of the political union. But I think that's precisely the reason why Britain was right to leave this political union, because it is a political project, and I think quite often that's come at the expense of doing what's right by citizens.
All right, Ryan Bourne at the Cato Institute in favor of Brexit. Nicholas Veron is with us, senior fellow at Bruegel. That's a think tank based in Brussels. Its membership includes EU member states, some of these others, so-called, the other 27 that are part of the union. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. I have to mention that our membership also includes the UK government and the Bank of England.
At least at the moment.
We hope they will stay.
Okay. Well, what about the concerns that have been expressed in the past, the people in London particularly, who didn't want to do this, whereas others around the country did? How now are you, other countries, concerned about what's going to happen next? What do you want to see happen to Article 50, or do you want to punish Britain for what it's doing?
I certainly don't want to punish anybody, and I don't think the EU wants to punish Britain. I think the EU is, we heard the word bombast from both Jeremy and Ryan. I don't see a lot of bombast in the EU institutions at this point. The tone is rather sober. The general perception is that Brexit is going to damage everybody, is going to damage the UK, but is also damaging to the EU. So the general mindset is one of damaged limitation. And even so, there are differences across member states of perception and orientation. Generally speaking, I think the same is true in most of the member states, if not all.
Why do you say that it will damage everybody, and in what way?
Well, Ryan talked about free trade and the benefits of free trade. The single market is the most deep project of trade and economic integration in many ways in the world. So having the UK cut off from the single market, which is a decision that has already been made, is not subject to future negotiation, is a big loss in terms of trade and economic integration. So this is very damaging.
So Ryan Bourne, is there a contradiction here? Is the single market the same thing as free trade? Why have Brexit? Why is it good for anybody?
Well, free trade is a component of the single market, but the single market is a lot more than about free trade. Really, the single market is best thought of as a single regulatory zone. Now, I accept in many instances that works well in terms of preventing individual member state governments from invoking protectionism or enacting protectionist policies. But we've also got to remember the single market also imposes new regulations, in many cases, I think, damaging regulations, particularly in areas like agriculture, sometimes financial services, clinical trials, and a host of other areas. But the second component of the European Union is that it's a customs union. And one of the first things you're taught as an economics student is that customs unions tend to be bad for trade overall, because what they do is erect barriers, tariff barriers and quota barriers to countries outside of the customs union, which is precisely what the European Union does. So, yes, there are some benefits in terms of trade of being a member of the single market, but let's not forget that the European Union is a customs union as well, and we all pay the price for that as consumers in Britain through higher prices than we'd otherwise face if we had zero tariffs on the rest of the world.
So, Nicholas Veron, has the EU overstepped in terms of regulations, and is there liable to be a move now for protectionism against Britain?
So first on the customs union, I think the statement that customs unions are bad for trade is really bizarre. So I'm not sure how Ryan understands it, because the UK will revert to WTO status, which is less favorable in terms of free trade than a customs union or equivalent. So that's a bit of a strange statement to make. Now, on your question about regulation, I think there's a legitimate question about whether EU regulation is too onerous, and I think it's certainly possible to find examples where EU regulation has been onerous. Now, if you discuss with people in the financial services industry, for example, in London, they will generally tell you that they are pretty fine with EU regulation, with the possible exception of the limitation of bonuses, which obviously is not popular in the city. But there have been onerous regulatory initiatives which were domestic UK initiatives in the last few years that they're not too happy with. For example, the separation, the ring fencing of commercial versus investment banking in the large financial institutions, which was essentially a UK-only initiative. So I think the proposition that by being outside of the EU, the UK will necessarily have less onerous regulation for business, not even entering into the debate of the cost-benefit analysis of such regulation, I think is a proposition that will be tested in the future.
Well, now let me ask you, or let me introduce another idea here. Voters in Scotland recently voted against independence from the UK, but they also voted in favor of staying in the EU. Now, the First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, met with Theresa May because yesterday the Scottish Parliament has approved another referendum on independence. Here's what Nicola Sturgeon said to the BBC.
Well, firstly, I want the UK to get a good deal. But when that deal emerges, I think people in Scotland should have an informed choice about whether that's the path they want to take or whether they want to take the path of becoming an independent country.
Magnus Linkletter is a former Scottish editor for the Times of London. He's based in Edinburgh. Thank you for joining us.
Not at all. Pleasure.
Do you think that Scotland will vote to become independent if it has the chance? At the moment, I believe it's the Prime Minister of the UK who has the opportunity to prevent that if she wants to.
Yes, she certainly has that power and has made made it absolutely clear that she's not willing to grant that power for the time being. She's told the Scots, you wait until you see what the outcome of Brexit is, i.e., 2 years or more down the line, and then possibly you may be able to hold your referendum. This is against a background where even the Scots are slightly doubtful about whether they want a referendum. We had one in 2014. Those who voted for independence were outnumbered by those who voted to stay by about 10%. And the polls suggest that those numbers haven't moved significantly. So although Nicola Sturgeon sees this as a great opportunity to put the idea once again to the Scots, I don't think the Scots themselves are very keen on staging what would be a very, very divisive vote.
But she is the First Minister. There must be some support behind her for independence.
There's certainly support from her own supporters. Of course, she sees this as a great opportunity. She has always said, by the way, that if there is a vote to pull out of Europe by Britain against a background where most Scots want to stay in Europe, that would be a trigger for another independence referendum. But, you know, amongst Scots at the moment, the mood is not very enthusiastic for that. I think that they would not share her enthusiasm.
All right. Magnus Linkletter, once again, a former Scottish editor for the Times of London, based in Edinburgh. We're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue this conversation. We'll talk more about the powers of the Prime Minister of Britain and what she can and can't do as this negotiation with the EU begins. Today's talking point later, with a swipe of the pen, President Trump can make internet privacy a thing of the past in the United States. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, They admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them you were just on a podcast of To The Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. The establishment of the European Union 60 years ago was an extraordinary moment in history. Now the departure of Britain from the EU is an extraordinary moment in history as well. Back to Jeremy Cliff, a political editor and columnist for The Economist magazine. How does this impact individuals in both Britain and the rest of Europe in terms of the services that they receive as a result of the European Union? Is going to impact their health care in addition to the price of goods and things of that kind?
It will indeed. And there are about roughly, well, the figures are fairly vague, but there are roughly 2 million Europeans living in Britain and almost as many Britons living in the rest of the European Union. And the big question now, which really still hasn't been answered even almost a year after the referendum, is what mutual rights will be granted to these people. And I think this will be a major priority of the upcoming negotiations. You know, Theresa May wants a reciprocal recognition of rights. She wants Britons outside of their home country living in the rest of Europe to be able to enjoy things like welfare rights and health rights and pension rights. And she wants to grant the same to Europeans living in Britain. The question is whether or not the rest of the EU will kind of go her way on that. I suspect they will. I suspect that should be a fairly easy win for her. But ultimately, you know, this is, you know, already there have been many months of uncertainty for these people. You know, I myself split my time between Berlin and London, and I know many Brits living in Germany who've now had to endure the best part of a year in which they don't even know whether they will retain their right to work in the country that they live in, whether they will have the right to go to a hospital and not have to pay, you know, for treatment, whether or not they will have the right to send their children to school in the country. And so already a lot of damage has been done. And I think many of us, actually on both sides of the Brexit versus Remain divide, really hope that this will be sorted out soon.
So, Ryan Bourne, back to you with Cato. You're in favor of Brexit. Are you supportive of that kind of uncertainty for so many people?
No, certainly not. And I think one of the main main areas in which Theresa May's gone completely wrong is I think she should have really taken the moral high ground on this issue. And actually, as administratively difficult as it would have been, chosen a sort of trigger point and said that any EU citizen in the living and working in the UK up until that point has full rights. I think she should have done that unilaterally. I don't think she should be granting this uncertainty to people in their everyday lives or using them as a sort of bargaining chip to get reciprocal rights with other EU countries. I think these negotiations would have got off to a lot better start if she'd have taken that measure from the UK's perspective alone and really taken the high ground on this.
Back to Nicolas Veron at Bruegel, based in Brussels. Brussels, the organization that includes EU member states. Should Theresa May have done what we just heard suggested?
Yeah, I agree with Ryan on this. I also agree that this probably won't be a big bone of contention in the forthcoming negotiation, but in the meantime, there will have been a lot of uncertainty for a lot of people, and that's unfortunate, should have been avoided. But I don't expect this to be a major point of disagreement.
Magnus Linkletter, back to you in Edinburgh. It's my understanding that Theresa May has powers that go all the way back to Henry VIII in this matter. Can you explain that? And especially to people who can't keep track of the Henrys.
Well, I'm not sure I can keep track of the Henrys either.
I'm not sure it's possible to keep track of the Henrys.
But, yeah, she does have that power. And, of course, the Scots can only just sort of watch now from a distance to see how all this pans out. It may pan out in such a way that the Scots think, hey, I think we want to stay in this United Kingdom. They've got a pretty good deal out of Europe. Why on earth break away at this stage? That might well happen. And on the other hand, if the negotiations turn out badly, then I think it could go the other way.
Ryan Bourne with Cato. Do you think it would be a good idea for the Scots to break away from Britain? After all, Britain's breaking away from the EU.
Well, I have some sympathy with the SNP view that there's been a material change. There would have been a material change in the constitutional arrangements of Scotland. And, you know, the convention in the UK over recent years is that if that is to be the case, then there should be a plebiscite, there should be a referendum to ratify that decision. I do think it's a bit intellectually incoherent, though. What Theresa May has clearly done today, setting out her strategy, is sort of said, of the powers that we get back from Brussels as a result of Brexit, I am willing to devolve more powers to the Scottish Parliament. So then you're going to be in the bizarre position, if Nicola Sturgeon wants to take Scotland back into the European Union, she will be making the argument that it's within Scotland's interests and within the Scottish Parliament's interests to give up powers to go back into the European Union. And given that she's sort of talked for years and years about the need for Scotland to control its own destiny, that seems to me to be a bit intellectually incoherent.
Nicholas Ferron at Bruegel. What about Angela Merkel, and what role do you think she will play? Will this turn out to be Ms. Theresa May versus Angela Merkel?
Well, I think that's an oversimplification. Germany is certainly the pivotal, most central, most important member state in the rest of the Union, the EU27. But Germany is not alone, and it's not calling the shots that simply. I mean, it's extremely influential, but it's a more complex setup. So the voice of Mrs. Merkel matters a lot, but it's not like she's making all the decisions alone. It is notable that the 27 member states, other than the UK in the EU, have displayed a quite impressive show of unity since the UK vote. There was a lot of expectations that there would be divergent agendas for different member states and public disagreement on how to approach a UK negotiation, and we've had very little of this. So I think one of the big questions going forward is whether this unity will continue when we enter into an active phase of negotiation, given that at the end of the day, not the agreement on withdrawal, but the agreement on the permanent relationship, on free trade and all that, will need to be approved by all member states, unanimity of 27 member states. And that requires it represents a high threshold in terms of consensus.
Nicholas Ferron, another question to you. What about the British civil servants that are living now in Brussels? They have pensions. They'll be looking for compensation, presumably. Where are they going to get it?
Well, they're going to get their compensation from EU institutions if they work for EU institutions, because that's where the contractual relationship exists. But there is a question of how much the UK will contribute to that, and that's one of the many components of the negotiation on the separation, on the withdrawal of the UK. So there's this big question of what will be the bill, if you will. The bill is not a penalty imposed on the UK for leaving the EU. Nobody's talking about this. It's just how to account for the financial commitments that the UK has taken and that continue to exist until the point where the UK has left the EU and the financial commitments are extinguished. So that's a mix of political and pure accounting discussions, and it will be a big component of the negotiation to come.
A lot of bouncing around here. Magnus Linklater, back to you. And I understand you need to leave us very soon. But when people in the United States particularly think about Scotland separating itself from Britain, I take it there would be issues of crossing boundaries maybe it would be difficult for tourists from the United States to visit both countries at the same time. Are those the kinds of things, or are they among the things that would make it very difficult for the Scots to, in fact, separate themselves from Britain after all these years?
I definitely agree with that. I think we haven't really contemplated the harsh reality of what they call hard borders between Scotland and England, two countries that have been joined in a single union for more than 300 years. And to be honest, I think if you really confronted people with that kind of practical issue, they would have, certainly the Scots would have deep doubts about that. I think the English would too. I don't think anybody really in their hearts wants to contemplate that kind of thing. But nevertheless, it could well be that in 2 years' time, if there is in fact to be another independence referendum at that stage and the Scots vote, yes, this time around, we want to go for it, that is what will happen.
What about the divided nation, if that's the right term for it, of Ireland?
Yes, well, that will happen, you see. Well, that is a much more closer reality, because when Britain pulls out of Europe, which it will, the hard border will be between north and south of Ireland. And that takes us back to the dark ages of the Troubles. Again, I don't think anybody wants to contemplate that.
Well, Magnus Linklater, it's been great to have you on our program, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Not at all.
Former Scottish editor of the Times of London, once again based in Edinburgh. So, Jeremy Cliff, back to you with The Economist. There would appear to be more trouble than it's worth for Scotland to separate, and yet it's still possible. Much depends on what Theresa May does with all this power that goes back to Henry VIII.
Yes, indeed. And if I could add a few points about that, I think this is very important. You know, the legislative power that this gives, that is going to be in Theresa May's hands in the coming months, goes all the way back to, as you say, Henry VIII and the Statute of Proclamations in 1539. This was, as some of your readers, your listeners may know, the king who had six wives. He started off as quite a liberal international monarch and became gradually more authoritarian. And this statute was a product of his more autocratic final years. And it basically allowed him to overrule the British legislature. And these powers still lie in the hands of the British executive. And what many of the powers that are now reverting, or will now in the coming months, revert back from Brussels to London do is they will give this, they will enable Theresa May to invoke this statute and enable her to effectively meddle with these powers that apply to all sorts of things to do with British life, you know, employment, the environment, people's human rights. This withdrawal from the European Union gives the British executive enormous amounts of power, and I think that is fairly poorly appreciated at the moment. And I think especially at a time when the opposition party in Britain, the Labour Party, is so weak, I really worry about the quality of the scrutiny and the quality of the sort of cross-examination that happens in Westminster in the coming months, because I think it's going to be a really crucial time. And if we're not careful, we could see a lot of decisions made without proper oversight.
Ryan Bourne with Cato, you're in favor of Brexit, but are you concerned about Theresa May and all this power?
Well, I'm concerned with any concentrations of power. I think, though, what the government have clearly articulated they're trying to do is to try and smooth the transition as much as possible. So they've announced that they're going to introduce a great repeal bill, which will do anything but, which will actually transpose all existing EU law into UK law. So the way that I like to think about leaving the European Union is really to think of it as a process rather than an event. It's as if you're driving along in an EU bus on a road, and the bus pulls over and you get out and you jump into another vehicle. To start off with, the road will look exactly the same. But over time, once we change pieces of legislation, decide to change different regulations or whatever, you start getting a deviation from the path that the EU is currently taking. So, yes, in principle, of course, I'm concerned with any significant concentrations of power. But it's been pretty clear, and I think the government has articulated pretty well, that what they're actually trying to do here is just transpose as much or all EU law into UK law to start with, and then we can deal with individual laws and regulations through the ordinary democratic process that for, you know, hundreds of years before being a member of the European Union, we adhered to.
Nicholas Varone, you said at the outset that this will be bad not just for Britain but for all the other 27 countries in the EU as well. What about the impact on the United States and on Americans in general?
Well, I first have to say that as somebody who lives in the rest of the EU, I don't feel that my bus is going over the cliff. So it's true that we had a bumpy road in the Eurozone over the past few years, but that the road is actually smoother, I think, going forward for the rest of us. other than the UK. In terms of the US, the impact is differentiated, I guess, depending on what you look at. There's an opportunity, which is that a lot of the financial services business that is currently done in the City of London is sort of up for grabs, and a lot of the media attention is focused on what sort of business and jobs will move to the EU27, but it's actually likely that some of it will move to New York. So that's a relatively limited impact, but important in that industry. Now, more generally, I think there are much bigger strategic and geostrategic implications of Brexit, which are still difficult to understand because we don't know exactly what sort of relationship will exist between the UK and the EU. The US has a long-standing interest in the Atlantic Alliance, and until now that included the EU, including the UK and the other countries. Now, we have a question mark on the relationship between the UK and the rest of the EU. We have a much bigger question mark in terms of the US commitment to the Atlantic Alliance, NATO, and more generally its web of alliances created since the last World War. So I would say more question marks probably in the immediate future on the US side than on the European side of this. But it's going to be a much more complex game once the UK and the EU go into separate paths on a number of dimensions.
Jeremy Cliff, a final question, if you can answer it briefly. It's a big question. The EU is considered a great experiment. Has that experiment failed?
No, I don't think it has. I think Britain was always an exceptional European state. You know, even going back to the very speech by Winston Churchill just after the Second World War in Zurich, in which he called for a United States of Europe, there's even debate about that to this day, about whether or not he meant Britain to be part of that or not. And I think that speaks to the ambiguity about Britain's relationship. You know, Britain talks about Europe in the third person. I think while I really regret the fact that we're leaving the European Union, I deeply regret it, I think that Britain is not a typical European country. Britain has always been sort of halfway between Europe and the rest of the world. And, you know, Brexit, I think, is an expression of that ambiguous identity. The rest of the European Union is different. And if you actually look at some of the opinion polls recently, support for membership of the EU in a lot of European countries has actually risen since Brexit. Now, obviously, the success or otherwise of Brexit will shape those numbers. But I think that it's a great blow to the European project, Britain leaving, and I think there's a lot of regret in European countries, in Berlin, in Paris, in Brussels, in other capitals. But I don't think this is going to destroy the European Union in one blow. I think the European Union will evolve, and here's the optimist in me speaking. I think this might shake the European Union out of its complacency and force it to adapt and reform and modernize. I hope that's the case, but I'm sad that Britain is not going to be part of that story.
Jeremy Cliff, once again, political editor and columnist for The Economist. Ryan Bourne at the Cato Institute in favor of Brexit. Nicolas Varon in Brussels with Bruegel, membership including the EU member states, and our earlier guest, Magnus Linklater, with the formerly with the Times of London. Thank you all very much for being on our program, and we'll obviously want to follow this as the negotiations go on. Great to have you all. Internet privacy in this country appears about to be coming to an end. We'll talk about that in a moment on To The Point from Public Radio International.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Well, we're not only here with today's talking point. Most Americans don't have a choice about their internet provider, which has a monopoly in their neighborhood, Comcast, Time Warner, whatever it may be. Starting last year, they did have the option to tell their provider not to take their most intimate information and sell it to the highest bidder. Now, if the president signs a bill passed by both houses of Congress, that option to deny permission will disappear. Laura Moy is Deputy Director at the Center for Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University's Law Center. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, thank you. It was the Obama FCC, Federal Communications Commission, that established this permission system just last year. How did it get removed by the Congress so quickly?
That's right. So there's a law called the Congressional Review Act, and it enables Congress essentially to undo the action of a federal agency, a recent action by a federal agency. So because the Federal Communications Commission, under our previous administration, passed these strong privacy rules in late October, that was recently enough that our new Congress was able to come in and undo that rule. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. You were going to make another point.
I was just going to say, so the Senate voted last week to undo that rule, and yesterday the House of Representatives voted as well and decided by a 215 to 205 vote to undo those rules, removing the rules that we had that would prevent broadband internet providers from sharing or selling information about their customers without permission.
Was this a rush to get a victory for the Republicans after the failure of the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare?
It does seem that way. I don't think it's accidental that the vote in the Senate happened the day after the failure of the health care bill. It seems like maybe there was a major failure and the Republicans were eager to get through what they view as a victory shortly after that. So the Senate vote happened a few days ago and the House vote followed in quick succession. It was very fast.
Why is this a victory for Republicans?
So, there are a few reasons. I think that the biggest one is that the industry here, the internet providers themselves, have been asking Republicans and in general regulators not to regulate them in this way, not to force them to provide privacy protections for their customers that, while very good for consumers, are of course something that it does cost companies to provide. So in my opinion, based on what I've seen, it seems like it's the companies themselves that have been mostly asking for these changes. They have done a lot of lobbying. They've provided a lot of campaign contributions, and they really have been touting this message far and wide across the Hill here in Washington.
So if you're opposed to government intervention in people's lives, I guess it raises an interesting question. They don't want to have intervention into the lives of the internet providers, these massive corporations, but they are willing to allow them to interfere in the lives of ordinary Americans. What does this give the internet providers the option to do that they didn't have before?
It takes away the rules that governed what they could do. So I think it's unclear exactly what internet providers will start to do with their customers' information. But the worst case scenario is that they view this as a green light to start selling information about their customers to the highest bidder.
What kind of information?
Well, so everything that you do online, or every site that you visit, every app that you use, a lot of information about you from dating sites that you may visit to sites where you are researching medical conditions, to sites where you are reading political news, or reading about political candidates. All of this activity that you do online is visible to an internet provider. So from that information, they might be able to derive details about your political viewpoint, your sexual preferences, and just your private life in general. So that type of information, I'm sure you can think of lots of examples, that type of information could be for sale.
Would it include financial information, where you're shopping, what your credit rating might be?
So it may include information about that. So let's say that you are you're browsing a gun auction site, for example, or let's say that you're browsing a site that sells pet products. An internet service provider might be able to see that and guess that you are in the market for a product that you might find on one of those sites.
So they can detect then just browsing. If all you're doing is looking at sites, they don't know why you're doing it, but they can find out that you are doing it.
Sure, yes, and they can see what site you're visiting and through that learn a lot of information about you. And that's just websites that you use. For many people in the modern era, their primary connection to the internet is through a mobile device where they are primarily using apps. And internet service providers can also see in many instances, what apps an individual is using on their phone. So if you are using a dating app, or if you're using an app that interfaces with maybe a home connected device at home, your internet provider might know information about that as well and be able to guess when you're home, when you're not, when you are looking for a date, might be able to tell all kinds of information about your private life from apps as well.
And back to the issue of shopping, you mentioned browsing a gun site. Don't they already do that? If you look at a site, whatever it might be, whether you're looking for shoes or underwear, pretty soon you're getting advertising for the stuff that you were looking at.
That's right. Yes. So, so that the rules that were eliminated yesterday were rules that governed what your internet provider itself, so the Comcasts, Verizons, and AT&Ts of the world, what they can do with the information that they have access to by virtue of the fact that they provide you with that gateway to the internet. Those rules did not govern what online advertising companies or analytics companies that that use, for example, cookies on the internet to track your behavior. It didn't govern what they can do with your private information.
A lot of excuse me for interrupting, but I wanted to ask one more question. A lot of the people, including our listeners, including me for that matter, don't really understand this stuff very well. What about members of Congress? Are they savvy enough to know that they can now be spied on and have all our information shared in the way that you describe?
I am not sure. It does seem awfully short-sighted to me that members of Congress, who I'm sure many members of Congress would be terrified to imagine information about their private browsing habits or what they're doing in the privacy of their own home, to imagine that information could be for sale or could be shared with someone else without their permission. So maybe they don't understand it. That said, you know, there was a rousing speech in the House yesterday by Representative Capuano, who said that that now his internet provider might be able to sell information about what size underwear he wears, and that that seemed to indicate a pretty good understanding of what's at stake here. He though voted against the bill.
Okay. I guess that information will be valuable to somebody. And once again, it's not law yet. We had the permission to prohibit all this because of the Obama FCC. And now Congress has overridden that, but President Trump has yet to sign the bill. Laura Moy, Deputy Director of the Center on Privacy and Technology at Georgetown University, thanks a lot for being with us.
Great. Thank you.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.